Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In less than 50 years, we have lost 60% of the world's mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles. As many as a million species are now facing swift extinction. In his new book, Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time, today's guest, journalist Ben Ehrenreich, examines how the unprecedented pace of destruction to the planet has led us to the brink of calamity. He also writes the notion of time. If time really is ending, if these are end times, maybe it's worth pausing to ask, what is time? How do we understand it? And why do we experience it the way we do? Ben Ehrenreich writes about these issues for The Nation. His work has appeared in many publications, including Harper's and the New York Times Magazine. In 2011, he was awarded a National Magazine Award. His last book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine, was one of The Guardian's best books of 2016. He has also written two novels. And Ben Ehrenreich joins us overseas from London. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, it's great to have you, Ben. Congratulations on this book. Congratulations on all of the great reviews that you're getting. Before we dive in and talk about this book, you spent some time in Barcelona. You were just there. And gosh, I remember in the first couple months of COVID, things were really bad in Spain. I was watching it really closely. They have since opened up on June 21st. Can you just give us an update about the COVID situation in Spain?
Sure. Yeah, I left there. I'd been living there and left there almost 2 weeks ago, now visiting my partner's family in the UK. But things had been opening up. We had an extremely strict lockdown. I think it was the strictest in Europe. We weren't allowed out for walks at all. You're really just confined to your home except to go out for essentials. And even then you could be stopped by police, you know, and had to show proof of why you're out in the streets. And the good news was that it really seemed to work. And they took a, unlike in most states in the U.S., they took a quite rigorous approach to reopening. And they only opened certain regions at a time, and only when they had reached certain benchmarks in terms of, you know, in terms of the spread of infections and in terms of the availability of hospital beds and all of that sort of thing. So the city opened, and it was possible to go out and feel relatively secure that the people around you were not going to give you a disease that would kill you, which was nice. Yeah. Unfortunately, there have been outbreaks all over. Most of them, none of them completely out of control, but there's been one in Catalonia, in the area of Lleida, and there have been some smaller outbreaks in Barcelona, I think. And, you know, I think it goes to show that Catalonia now has very strict mask laws, which I think is a very good thing. You have to be wearing a mask if you're outside your house, basically. But that wasn't the case for all of the time after they started reopening. And, you know, I think people are just figuring out how to live with this virus. And even being quite strict and careful, there are going to be outbreaks many steps backwards. And of course, most places in the U.S. have been anything but strict and careful.
What are people in Europe saying about what is happening here in the United States?
Well, to the degree that they're aware of it, because I think people focus very locally on the COVID situation. But the degree that they're aware of it, they know that it's a complete mess. But I think something happened to the European consciousness vis-a-vis the U.S., maybe 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago after Trump's election, where they kind of just shake their heads. And I think most Americans would be perhaps a little surprised at the degree to which most of the rest of the world has really moved on. And does not think of the U.S. anymore as the center of power or the center of anything, and sort of clucks pitiably when they hear news from the U.S., which certainly didn't happen a few years ago.
You know, it's so interesting you say that, Ben, because I was in Italy and Prague in October, and I just assumed that a lot of people would say, what's going on in your country? What is the deal with Trump? No one talked about it. I mean, they just talked about, we had great political conversations about history and things like that, but hardly anyone brought it up. I was actually surprised by that, but after a while, I just got used to it.
Yeah, no, I think that's been my experience too. And I think there certainly was a time when I think there are still parts of the world that do follow American news very, very carefully. I think in the UK they follow American news much more carefully than they do on the European continent. But I think people have kind of moved on. And in some ways, I think as an American, it's really good to be reminded, that we certainly are not the center of things. Mm-hmm. But it's been a pretty sobering fall these last few years.
Yeah. And I also, on the topic of COVID, since you write about time, I feel like a lot of people are talking more about time because those of us who can are still staying inside as much as possible. And here we are. And I mean, some of us went on lockdown in late February, early March, and people are kind of forgetting what day it is, forgetting that months are going by. What are your thoughts about, since you've spent so much time really thinking about time, what are your thoughts about time under COVID and, what it means?
Yeah, I certainly seen on social media and talked to friends who are saying similar things, joking about not knowing what day it is anymore, not knowing what year it is anymore. But also, I think becoming aware of the kind of plasticity of time and the flexibility of time, that without these, the routines and the social structures that establish time for us collectively, it loses its shape. And sometimes it moves really fast and sometimes it moves incredibly slowly. And sometimes it has these weird holes in it that you didn't know were there and big open spaces that you didn't know were there either. And it becomes increasingly clear that time is very much a social construction. That the way we experience time is something that we do together. It depends on the structures that we have, more generally as a society. And when those shift and when those enter crises, our experience of time also shifts. This was a non-COVID related, obviously, but it was a similar experience that led me to start thinking about the issues that became this book, Desert Notebooks.
And I also want to ask you, before we dive in and talk about your book, about the time that we're in right now with all of the protests happening, the uprisings. You're in Europe and Black Lives Matter protests have taken place in many cities around Europe. What are your thoughts about this moment?
It's really exciting. I mean, this is an absolutely terrifying moment. It's a really heartbreaking and upsetting moment. And it's a really exciting and at times inspirational moment. I think I read more people in the U.S. took part in the Black Lives Matter protest than any other protest movement in American history. That's absolutely extraordinary. And I was amazed that the protests spread, from beyond American borders throughout Europe. I went to two protests in Barcelona, and not just the ones I went to in Barcelona. One was very much in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. The other was bringing up issues of equality and racial injustice in Spain. But throughout Europe, they've also begun to grapple in various ways, with histories of racism, histories of slavery, histories of colonial violence and injustice. So, for instance, in Bristol, they threw the founding father slave trader statue into the river in the UK. In London, they had to put Winston Churchill in a box to protect his statue. Cecil Rhodes, has one of his statues removed. So, I think one of the sort of wonderful and surprising things that's happened is that the protests in the U.S. have actually inspired the rest of the world to into a reckoning with histories of racial violence that they were not doing on their own. So, you know, I think as centrist politicians fret about the U.S. losing its stature internationally, on the other hand, we can be, I think as Americans, we can be proud of this tradition of resistance and protest and insurrection, which began in the U.S., as it frequently does, and then inspired much of the rest of the world to start taking actions and really thinking hard about legacies that they had not yet grappled with. So if as an American, if you're looking for things to be proud of, I think that's a good one.
Yeah, and also to add to that list, a number of Spanish colonial statues are coming down. And it's almost like, you know, people are learning about things they didn't know before. Everything from Juneteenth to, you know, Junipero Serra and the California missions. And I really appreciate, not surprised because, you're very thoughtful about these issues, but you write a lot about Native history in your book, which we'll get into also during today's show.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's it's been exciting for me. I mean, because one of the things that I talk about in the book and that I've been thinking about for these last few years is the ways in which time seems to be folding back on itself a lot. Just in these last few years, I think, especially since Trump's election, and it's become more and more clear that time is not this, you know, linear thing that just keeps on moving, but something that holds the past within it. And it sometimes folds so that we have to deal with the past suddenly. And we're in one of those moments when all of these moments that we thought were forgotten, erased, et cetera, you know, Californian genocidal history, history of the of Seneca and the missions, and you know the entirety of the Native genocide that occurred alongside it. This is suddenly something that we're looking at again, and we're looking at it because George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. So it was all sitting there, you know, it was all waiting and sort of brewing and fermenting. This extraordinary trigger suddenly brought it all exploding into the open. And I think that, you know, that is a moment both of incredible opportunity and of extraordinary danger for all of us.
With this book, which you say you did not intend to write at all, much less to wage a battle against time, or at least against a certain conception of it, let's just talk about where this came from. You were hiking in Joshua Tree. Just tell us how you decided to write a book about time and what it means to be grounded in place.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of a cliche, but I feel more like this book decided to write me, or decided that I would write it. I didn't have a whole lot to do with it. But I was, like you said, I went out for a hike with a couple of friends. I was living in Joshua Tree, and at that point had been living there for, I think, more than a year. And while we were hiking and talking and hiking and talking, we were going up this wash, and we spotted these two owls. We frightened them, basically. They were roosting on the side of the wash. And they flew off and flew in front of us and then arced away into the distance farther up the wash. And we sort of went quiet and in awe because they were so beautiful, and then started hiking up after them. Not after them, but just happened to keep going the direction we were going. And every few minutes, we would encounter them again. And they would be startled again, and they would fly off again, and we would keep going. And it felt, we knew that this wasn't actually what was happening, but it felt like they were kind of leading us on further into the desert. And it was one of these, you know, if you spend time in, I think really anywhere in the wild, but certainly in the desert, you have these moments, right? You have these moments of encounter with, you know, with non-human life that are, that kind of blow your mind, that are magical and outside of all, you know, strictly human experience. And that night, I drove home, and after having dinner with these friends and, you know, talking about a lot of the things that the book ended up being about, talking about the sort of experience of time breaking down, talking about the sense that the, you know, that we're facing planetary catastrophe, and that really we may be looking at the end of something quite extraordinary. But we were feeling so good because we'd just been on this beautiful walk that these weren't scary things to think about. These were somehow, it was possible to think, to talk about these things, you know, and laugh and feel good about the beauty of existence. And I went home, and the next morning I woke up and I worked on whatever I was working on, and I kept working on it. And a few days later, I decided to write about that walk because it had been so beautiful, just to try to remember it. And I basically kept writing for a year. And I started writing, wrote it down. One of my friends at the time, while we were out there, had said something about the Popol Vuh, you know, the Quiche Maya creation book, in which owls appear. So I looked those up, and I read the Popol Vuh, and I started. Those led me to read something else, which led me to read something else, which led me to read something else. And frequently, it was owls that were making these associative connections. And I started to realize that as everything I was thinking about was sort of taking me further down that wash into the desert, and down further down these avenues of thought about time and about history, and that until I'd made sense of them, I wouldn't be able to stop writing. So I kept with it until I was done.
You lived in Joshua Tree for how long?
Not long enough, just about 2 years.
Okay. And so you lived on an acre of land about a 5-minute walk from the national park boundary. You have interesting stories about friends and family visiting, and some people really love the landscape and the feeling of it, and others not so much. What is it like to live in a place like this?
For me, it was more wonderful than I could have guessed. I mean, I'd lived in cities pretty much my whole life, and most of my adult life in Los Angeles. And I had to give up my place in LA because the house was being sold. And I think Los Angeles, like the Bay Area, has extremely high real estate prices. And I figured, well, I could be another gentrifier or I could just get out. And I found a place quite inexpensively in the desert. And I had spent time there over the years, so I certainly knew the landscape, I knew the place, but I think being there for more extended periods of time was far more transformative than I expected it to be. You know, I mean, part of it, I think, is certainly isolation. You know, I had friends out there, but it's not like having a friend down the block. You know, the physical landscape is so expansive that you really have a sense of your own smallness. But I think the thing that was perhaps most transformative was this thing that the desert shouts at you all the time. And I think this is the reason why some people love it and other people hate it, is it shouts at you that you are not the center of the universe. Mm. That there's so much going on out there. You know, once you start to be attentive to it, the desert is not a place of barrenness and nothingness. You know, it's absolutely teeming with life and with constant transformation, you know, both on these, you know, immediate quick scales and on these, you know, scales of millennia that you can sort of see the evidence of, but not, of course, observe. And if you start to pay attention, it completely decenters your sense of self. And which is, you know, I think something that was long past due for me, and is, you know, I think both a profoundly humbling and, you know, an educational experience.
How given what you just talked about, when you think about what's going on with the planet and the climate crisis, I love the way you wrote the book because it's almost like a journal in some ways. You write about what's happening with Trump, who you call Rhino, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But then you talk about news, and then you talk about history and articles you come across and history that you learned and books you're reading. And given that you were just so close to, well, I guess just away from the city, really, and then reading about the climate crisis, how has that changed your perception of where we are and the urgency around this versus, you know, living in a city and just, you know, working and kind of being doing the thing that you usually do without many breaks and without really connection to the outside world?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd certainly been aware, like most people are, of the climate crisis living in cities. We feel the weather change. We feel the climate change. But I think being intensely aware of the complexity of the web of life around you, and having some sense of the larger ecosystem in which you live, a larger non-human ecosystem, and these extraordinarily resilient and at the same time extraordinarily fragile balances. I think watching that shift and seeing the difference if it's hotter than it was, and certain plants don't bloom because you didn't get much rain that the previous winter, or if instead, and I record a winter like this, if you have a winter where you get extraordinary amounts of rain, you get this wild, extraordinary bloom in the spring. So every time you open your door, you're aware of that web of life and the degree to which it's in or out of balance, if you're really attentive. And that does shift, I think, your sense of the urgency and the intimacy of the climate crisis in a way that is harder to appreciate in a city.
And as you write, you cite a number of articles about the climate crisis. You say, I read articles like this almost every week. I don't look for them. One is about something called marine ice cliff instability, the idea being that as ocean temperatures rise and icebergs break away from the glaciers that cover West Antarctica, they reveal higher and higher cliffs of ice. If the cliffs reach a certain height, the ice will no longer be able to support its own weight and will begin to crumble off in giant shards. We actually did a show about what's happening in Antarctica just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, good. It's terrifying, huh?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Ben, after the election, we knew that the media would focus on, you know, Trump's tweets and the latest scandal. I mean, they're just happening every day. So we decided to dedicate every Monday to the climate crisis because we knew that it just wasn't going to get enough attention in the national media.
Yeah. I think for a lot of people, it's pretty easy to forget about it. So that's really wonderful.
You also cited another piece about climate scientists forecasting that temperatures will rise 3.4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. And, we've done a lot of shows about this. I think that this got more attention, but then COVID hit. So what are your thoughts about what really needs to be done to create a sense of urgency around these issues?
Well, it's hard to know because even on the one hand, even with COVID, in the U.S., I think we can take the current death counts as like the minimum of the number of people who have actually been, died to this disease. And we look at alongside that, not only this like absolute, criminal, abysmal failure by government at all levels to respond to this, in any way that would help to save people's lives, but also the response by a significant part of the population that insists that they will not be inconvenienced even the smallest ways in order to save the lives of others. All of that is I think, profoundly upsetting, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even the hundreds of, more than 100,000 people dying just in the last few months, people cannot rouse themselves to change the way they live in order to save others. You know, on the other hand, I think for a lot of us, it has made it absolutely clear the ways in which our government won't help us, the ways in which corporate America certainly won't help us, and the ways in which our government and I think capitalism generally are actually actively killing us. And so I think it has made the fight very clear. And it's exactly the same fight that we need to fight in terms of the climate crisis. I think the things that are pushing the pandemic and making it more virulent, you know, things I think that are drawing, you know, all of these new infectious diseases to us over the last half century or so are precisely the same kind of factors that are pushing the climate crisis. You know, as wild lands are being destroyed, as the interface between human societies and formed recently wild lands is getting bigger and bigger, and all these diseases are jumping into urban centers. You know, I think it also, I don't want to underestimate, and this might be naive, but nonetheless, I don't want to underestimate how transformative it was for a lot of people to witness in the first weeks of the lockdown, in the places where there was a real lockdown, the sudden transformation of the earth. Yeah. You know, the smog disappeared, the sky was clear, the air was breathable, it smelled good, birds reappeared, you know, all of nature seemed to be absolutely rejoicing at the fact that we were no longer abusing the planet in the way that we have been for, you know, most of this last century. It's hard for me to believe, and you know, I think in most places that's over now, and we've picked up again, and pollution levels have gone up, and the birds are going back to their pre-lockdown, you know, clandestine behaviors. But I think for a lot of us, like that was so extraordinary and so completely unimaginable. And I think just what it does to sort of knock people's imagination, I think, is something pretty important. Because, you know, for all of these years, we've been told, yeah, I know we'd have to get off fossil fuels to do anything about climate change. We can't do it. We just can't do it. You know, there's all these things that we know we have to do, but we can't because they're impossible. And then suddenly, within weeks, over the entire planet, all those things that were supposed to be impossible, we did them. Like, we suddenly did them. And the realm of the possible suddenly, I think, in a lot of people's minds, got bigger. And then I think it also became very clear, we did those things, and then certain forces in our society said, hey, we're not making money anymore. You need to get back to work, even if it kills you, even if it kills the planet. And we know who those people are. Right. And we won't forget. And so, you know, we know what the problem is, and we know what we're capable of, I think.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich about his new book, Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. He examines how the unprecedented pace of destruction to the planet is leading us to the brink of calamity, and he also writes about time. What is time, and how do we understand it, especially today? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Thank you.
is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich. He writes about the climate crisis for The Nation. He is also author of The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. It was one of The Guardian's best books of 2016. He's the author of two novels, and his new book is Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. And Ben writes about the unprecedented pace of destruction to the planet. And then what is time? How do we understand it, especially today? So what are your thoughts about that, Ben? Just how we, you know, understand time when we're running out of time when it comes to the climate crisis?
Well, you know, the things that as I read more and more in the research for this book, the two things that became clear about the way we experience time are that it is shaped first of all, in terms of the broad sweep of history, that sort of long sense of time that we have, and in our immediate experience of it, days, minutes, hours, by, for lack of better words, by white supremacy and colonialism and by capitalism. And that sounds like, you know, those are easy things to blame for stuff. But what I mean by that is, in terms of how we understand history, most people's sort of fallback understanding of the way time works is things get better over time. You know, like progress is, I think, a basically fundamental faith of modernity. And the more I looked into the origins of this really kind of strange notion, which is pretty historically recent and unique, that things get better and that things are destined to get better. What I found was that this was actually tied at every moment, you know, from its the first times it was articulated during the French Enlightenment, throughout its life in the 19th and 20th centuries, and I think even today, to colonialism and to white supremacy. That the thinkers who first started talking about progress did it by understanding their own societies, European societies, as the place of the future, and understanding particularly Africa and the Americas as the place of the past. So there were some people, and we call their societies things like backwards or primitive, which suggests that they actually belong in some other, you know, time period from the current one, who are in a certain place along this timeline, which is also a racial hierarchy. And there are other people, Europeans and you know, Anglo-Saxon North Americans, who are in a completely different slot along this timeline, which is also a racial hierarchy. So progress became a way of interposing white supremacy into history itself, into the way we understand chronology, and into the way we understand destiny, right? Because it meant that the domination of certain societies by other societies was understood just as the way history functions, the way time functions. And then the other side of that is that at around the same time, there was a major shift in the way, moment by moment, Europeans and North Americans began to experience time because of industrialization and because of capitalism, because labor changed with the development of capitalism. And as more and more people shifted to wage labor, they were paid according to their time. They were paid by the hour rather than by the piece or by the season or by some much older kind of arrangement. And people began to pay attention to, you know, every single moment of the day was suddenly equal to the money they could be making. Time became money. You could suddenly be wasting time. You could be spending time. These kinds of notions would have been nonsensical a century or even a few decades earlier. And, you know, look at us now with notions of, you know, time management. And we're all constantly worried about productivity and using our time and making sure we're not wasting time because, you know, every second and every minute should be used to be productive in order to turn it into money, basically. So time became fungible. So those are, I think, the two main things that have affected the way we understand and experience time. And both of them create the sense of time as this sort of smooth, linear progression. It's going somewhere, right? It's going to get better. You know, listen to Steven Pinker. It's getting better every day. But it's also something that's quite rational. It's quite abstract. You can cut it into pieces. A minute is a minute, no matter whose minute it is. A second is a second, no matter whose second it is. They can be measured. They can be interchanged, and they can be exchanged for money, certainly. And then something happens, right? Like this epidemic, or other societies have had, I think, more experience of this than the U.S. War does this. Various crises do this. But that smooth progression of events breaks down. And actually, I think, you know, a lot of people have probably had the experience on a personal level. That if you experience some kind of personal trauma that sort of pushes you outside of common experience, one of the things that it messes with is your sense of time. You're suddenly, you know, if you experience a trauma, your relationship to time changes compared to all of the people around you. And it's hard to insert yourself back into it. And I think that's true collectively as well.
And when we're talking about time and politics, and you write about this, time is used to postpone or not deal with real issues, including the climate crisis, including healthcare, economic injustice. There's just so much. The list goes on. But bringing it back to the climate crisis, you write, the IPCC and other scientists have issued warnings about the urgency to reduce the world's reliance on fossil fuels before it's too late. Trump upended everything. We have grown accustomed to politicians telling us, I should say before Trump upended everything, we have grown accustomed to politicians telling us that we have to be practical and modest, that we shouldn't expect too much. As you write, Barack Obama's favorite line was, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been this this sort of rational centrism, which defined certainly U.S. politics for a couple of decades until Trump came along, which relied on this very sort of smooth notion of time, in which you know, there would not be any radical breaks in time or in anything else, we had to always choose the compromises that would allow for, you know, the most practical solution to get things done. But I think, you know, it's become clear to a lot of us, and certainly to I think most young people at this point, that all of these practicalities were leading us immediately, you know, straight to destruction. That all of these practical decisions added up to the destruction of, you know, to the extinction of species after species, and perhaps even our own. And every single one of these decisions, of course, is entirely practical and rational and da-da-da-da. And, you know, we could have all these policy experts explain that to us again and again. But what they add up to is suicide on a species level. And not just suicide, right? Because it really works out in a more uneven and frankly homicidal terms, because the effects of climate change are not evenly distributed, and it is the poor globally and domestically as well who experience them far more intimately than the wealthy.
Today we're speaking with award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich about his new book, Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. We have an email from Philip. He wants to thank you for your work. He says, the desert is full of life and does teach us that we are, in fact, very small and not the measure of all things. And science teaches us that many deserts were once tropical or underwater. So I take consolation in the thought that nature and the planet will go with or without us, that change and extinction events are the norm, and that nature has a way of righting itself when it's thrown out of balance. It's another paradox of life that sorrow and joy from our perspective walk hand in hand.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one thing I think, I don't think I realized this quite, I don't think I would have been able to articulate this while I was writing this book. But looking back on it, it's clear to me that one of the things that I was thinking about and writing about constantly was how the desert has been conceived of, mainly by, you know, white settlers, both, you know, in the 1800s and today, as a place that's dead and barren, and a place that's really only good for, you know, extraction or destruction. Right? You can test A-bombs there, or we can, you know, tear it up while mining minerals out of it. And I understood the desert, the more time I spent there, as this place that was just wildly alive, you know, where there was just life absolutely everywhere, and it was in a state of constant transformation. And if we look at that metaphorically, I think the same problem is everywhere in front of us, that capitalism wants to see the world as dead, to put it bluntly. It wants to see all of humanity and all of nature as these, you know, dead resources that can be, you know, extracted and exchanged without any worry for how they might, what the effects might be on, you know, individuals or the ecosystem as a whole, the human and natural ecosystem. And of course, you know, we're not dead, and the planet is not dead. And I think as we push forward, I think we need to keep in the forefront of our minds and understanding, you know, that's not just, you know, strictly speaking, political, but something that that makes us remember all the time that that we are all us, and I don't just mean humans when I use that word, alive and dependent on one another. And that whatever solutions we come up with to the problems we have in front of us, which are enormous, has to take into account that vitality and the depth of those interconnections.
Hmm. We're almost out of time, Ben, but I do want to ask you about some of the native issues that you wrote about in your book. You got a fellowship in Las Vegas for a semester at a literary institute attached to UNLV. And you wrote a lot about the Paiute people, which was great because my grandfather was Paiute. His reservation was actually the Walker River Paiute Reservation. And so this was a nice surprise to read about this. You drove to the Walker River Paiute Reservation and you write, "The last shrinking remnant of a freshwater sea that 12,000 years ago covered this whole corner of the state. It's still shrinking faster now than ever. It's half as long and nearly 200 feet shallower than it was in 1880 when settlers began diverting the river to irrigate their farms." I mean, these are the fish that once sustained the Paiute and they've died. What can you just talk about that experience, what that was like, and just really learning about the Paiute?
Yeah, you know, I went to the Walker Reservation, Walker River Reservation, that's hard to say, specifically because a Paiute prophet named Wovoka is buried there. And he had a vision that became the foundation of the ghost dance religion, which spread from tribe to tribe throughout the Western United States. And was interesting to me in a lot of ways. One of them was very simply, it relied on a completely different notion of time, right? An understanding that time had actually ended. The collapse had already occurred. The catastrophe had occurred when white settlers arrived. But also that time could be reborn. And it was a vision of rebirth, of settlers disappearing from the land, the dead being reawakened, all of the animals who had been destroyed returning, and pointed at another way of understanding both our own history, but also of looking towards the future. That this doesn't have to be either a straight line into catastrophe, it doesn't have to be a straight line into anything. You know, that there are possibilities for both regeneration and resistance that are there for all of us at any moment.
Well, I really appreciate you writing about Native history, Ben, because it's pretty rare. And even though we are having a much needed conversation about the true history of this country, it's for many reasons, I should say, the conversation doesn't go back far enough. Sometimes genocide comes up, but it doesn't even go back further than that. So we just have a lot of work to do. So I just really appreciate you writing about Native history. And I hope that, you know, people can pick up your book to learn more about the Paiute people. It's just a really important. Ben's book is Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. In our remaining minutes, Ben, I just wonder, what role do you think that the media need to play in these perilous times? I mean, it's a big question. We're seeing a lot of better conversations and deeper conversations about race happening. But I'm noticing with COVID, a lot of outlets aren't going deep enough to really talk about the suffering that people are facing right now. So what are your thoughts about the role the media should play in these times?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think part of it has to do with the incredible distractedness of the media. Mm-hmm. You know, Trump tweets something and suddenly everybody's writing about it. And it's very, very hard to get a broader or a deeper view of anything because, Trump or someone else says, hey, look over there, and everybody looks, and then we're stuck talking about whatever nonsense is happening over there. And one of the things this means is, yeah, like we're not getting, a sense of how this pandemic is, the effects it's having on people's lives. But also, like you say, like we're not understanding the media in focusing on the absolutely new also, I think, often fails to give us the histories that we need. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you said, like I think most people in California are wildly ignorant, and not just California, but the United States as a whole, are wildly ignorant of the native histories of the very land on which they're sitting. You know, a lot of which are not just histories, are very much present for a lot of people in the country. And I think one of the other thing I would, you know, if I could have an ideal media, it would be to get rid of this notion of objectivity, to just kill it, let it die, you know, because I think it's become such a cover for a sort of tepid establishment thinking, and a cover for all of the prejudices of the moneyed classes. And, you know, I think this is probably never clearer than when the mainstream media publishes pieces on police violence, where the police are still always their first source. But I think, it's particularly at a time when the authorities are really actively killing, at this point, hundreds of thousands of people. I think for the media to pretend to this kind of objectivity, which still is submissive to the authorities in all the ways that it traditionally has been, is an absolute abandonment of the, I think, most useful role the media can play in any society, which is to be a watchdog on the powerful.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for writing this book, and congratulations, you're getting great reviews. And thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your time in Europe, and we'll see you back in the States.
Thanks a lot, Rose. It's a real pleasure to be on the show.
Ben Ehrenreich is an award-winning journalist who writes about the climate crisis for The Nation. His new book is called Desert Notebooks, A Roadmap for the End of Time. And he explores this moment. We have so much information now about what is happening to the planet. What does it mean? What does time mean during this crisis? I hope you can pick up his book because it really does focus on just a number of issues. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, Damian Miner, and David LaTulipe. Thank you so much for keeping the studio running. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.